I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Whether or not you believe in climate change, we are seeing the results of more severe weather here in Kansas City. With the current flooding of the Missouri River, today we'll look at how we can make our cities more resilient, learn exactly what that means, and what Kansas City and other municipalities can do to better withstand and recover from natural disasters. Then we hear about violence in Kansas City virtually every day, and we're not alone. Chicago has faced record-breaking shootings and homicides in recent years, and we'll talk with the author who tells the true stories of families struggling with love and death in Chicago. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When it comes to planning the cities of tomorrow, resiliency is a key ingredient. It must be in a world of global warming that is resulting in supersized storms, increased flooding like the kind seen in the Midwest in recent weeks, rising seas, and other climate impacts. Resiliency is the new driver behind urban design, and it's tricky because we don't know yet how the ramifications of global warming will wind up impacting Kansas City and other municipalities. Still, we must prepare. Joining us now is one of the leading experts in this new approach to urban design. That's Matthijs Bouw, who was just at the Kansas City Public Library talking about this. He's an architect and urbanist and founder of One Architecture. He's the director of the Urban Resilience Certificate Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His firm proposed the Big U. That's a plan to protect Lower Manhattan from flood water and storms. He joins us now from Baker Sound Studios in Philadelphia. Matthijs, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Well, I'm well. And do I have this right? Global warming is radically reshaping many aspects of what, architecture and design?
Yeah, I think so. Global warming really changes rain events and ocean levels rather quickly. We come from a relatively stable period where the weather and the climate was relatively stable in a period where there's big change. Sea levels are rising rapidly, and storms, as we see, are getting bigger. The world getting warmer.
Resiliency, then, and its design is not only how well we withstand an event, but how well and how quickly we can recover from it. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so part of it is how well we can recover, but it's also the idea that if you prepare well for these changes and for these catastrophic events, then you can start to not only adapt, but also transform for the better.
What does that mean?
So that means, for instance, what we're doing in New York is after a Superstorm Sandy, the city needed a coastal protection system. And what we are designing is not only a coastal protection system, but we are designing it as a park with a series of bridges and better connections to the neighborhoods that are close to the coast, so that it's not only an infrastructure for resilience, but it's also, in a way, a social infrastructure.
How much does this add to the bottom line cost of any project, this idea of resiliency? Does it increase costs rather dramatically?
I don't think the costs are really dramatic. I also think that the benefits often outweigh the costs.
How would you describe what climate change means for cities now and in the future? What are you seeing across the globe here?
Climate change is not equal around the globe. For instance, on the northeastern seaboard in the United States, sea level rises are much more than, let's say, around Alaska, where sea level rise isn't as much. You see that temperature is rising very much across the United States, and of course even more in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa and Asia.
You know, you stress this idea that the importance of not looking at the challenges of all this through a single lens like architecture. You say that the approach should be something more comprehensive. Tell us about that. What should be involved in cities becoming more resilient?
So I think the most important thing in making cities more resilient is to involve the communities and the different, let's say, actors, as you call it, in a city, in trying to think, how can we not only prepare, but also how can we use all these drastic changes to make our cities better? And in order to do that, you need more comprehensive planning processes, which are on one hand more inclusive in the sense that they bring the community into the conversation, but in which you also let the different city agencies and the different layers of government collaborate to make these better, more integrated solutions.
How big of a revolution in architecture and design is all this becoming? What's happening there when it comes to the sea change you're seeing in your profession?
What I see is that, and I work also in a university, I think, where you see a lot of students really excited about this. What it means is that we cannot, as designers, just wait for a client or a city agency to say, design this or that. What we need to do is we need to go through a process of discovering not only what are the more complex questions that are behind these questions and what are the opportunities. So we need to change the way in which we design from being sort of directly focused on one type of solution to a sort of more complex understanding of the changes that we are going through in our society, but also the opportunities that brings.
But that means building buildings in a more solid fashion. Doesn't that add considerable cost to what you're trying to do?
Yeah, it does add a lot of cost. But one of the great things that we have is we have nature, which is often really good at dealing with these type of problems. So often, if we don't think as much in what you call gray infrastructure or hard physical structures, but we let nature do the work in a smart way, the cost can be considerably less, and it can also help us deal with heat and create a better environment.
Well, what are you talking about when you say let nature help out here?
So one of the challenges, for instance, that Kansas City have is that there is a sewage overflow when it rains a lot. So mm-hmm. they need to spend a lot of money on sewage infrastructure and stormwater infrastructure. You can build pipes and culverts, which are very expensive. You can also use, let's say, your parks or parts of your streets to store the water, to let it slowly go back into the ground after a big storm. And through that, you can reduce the flood risk, but also have a better environment.
So what does that look like when you say store the water in parks or on the streets? What are you talking about?
Well, you can, if you redesign your parks, or if you design your parks in a certain way, you can start to think, can we include wetlands? Can we include what you call bioswales? Can we include and design environments that are better at holding water and often even cleaning water than current parks are?
And how would that apply to storing water on streets? What might that look like?
Well, one of the big problems and one of the causes of many flood events, including the flood events in the Midwest, is that there's a lot of impermeable surface. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of parking lots everywhere. There's wide streets, and all that water, because it cannot go back into the ground in its own pace, quickly sort of runs off into the waterways and causes flood. So if you reduce the amount of impermeable surfaces, and for instance, take away lanes or take away parking spaces or create in between the parking spaces green structures, you can hold that water and have it go back into the ground, water then quickly drain into the rivers and causing floods downstream.
Does it also include going back to dirt roads and not having every road hard surfaced?
No, I don't think that's the idea.
That's but going too far.
I get your point. But one of the things that we, of course, see is that in many cities and around, if you look at shopping malls, there's a whole lot of concrete and parking spaces. And you can sort of rethink specifically also because we see changes in how the people move through a city. We see more people using bikes. We see more people using shared vehicles. And that allows us to reduce the road surface and become a bit smarter about it. Sharing is a great way to make sure that we need less infrastructure.
I'm wondering about out in rural Kansas and Missouri, Matthijs, where flooding wiped out, you know, so much farmland and grazing in recent weeks. How can this idea of resilient design end up helping farmers and ranchers in our neck of the woods?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and a really important question. Often you see that along the river, such as the Missouri River, there's a system of levees that
right.
that are increasingly incapable of dealing with the floods, the size that we are starting to have now, and that will probably increase in the future. One of the ways in which we dealt with that in the Netherlands, and you do it at some places in the United States, I am from the Netherlands, is through a program called Room for the River, in which we create more space in the floodplain of the river, and we create softer shores which allow for more water to flow through the river and which allow for water to flow slower through the river. And that create that extra capacity then reduces the risk of the levees breaching and flooding the farmlands.
If I'm hearing you correctly, you're talking about wider channels. Do I have that right?
Yeah, but you shouldn't think like a channel is still very much an artificial solution. I think if you start to think about not only wider channels, but renaturing at some places, that can have fantastic effects.
You know, in the last several years, development along the Missouri River in Kansas City has begun. We're currently looking at a mixed-use project under construction directly behind Berkeley Riverfront Park at the river's edge. I saw in renderings of your projects a lot of green space between the water and buildings, and right away I'm thinking, you know, a buffer zone here. But how do you calculate how much area to devote to green space to get the most benefit from it?
Ooh, that's a very difficult question, and that really varies on a case-by-case level. What you normally do is that you create flood maps, you map the flood risk, and you create a hydrological model to understand better how much water needs to flow, and also at how high you need to make the parks or the green structures on the site of the river. I wouldn't be able to say it. I was in Kansas City about a week ago.
Right.
There the Missouri was at a pretty high point. It hadn't reached its top yet, but it still felt from that riverside development pretty safe and sound.
So you wouldn't necessarily have a red flag popping up about what we're doing along the riverfront there then?
No, I think one of the things that can happen. What I like about that development is that it has a density, it's sort of a relatively compact development, and the environmental benefits of compact urbanization are significant. So in that sense, I like the fact that people are exploring these beautiful places as places to live and to live in a relatively compact way. There are no real red flags now. Normally, At the same time, what you want to think about is, can you, as we start to understand the impacts of climate change better, do we still have the space to adapt in the future? So the fact that there is a green area there that could potentially be elevated in the future is a good thing.
Matthijs Bouw is my guest. We're talking about a new way to design urban structures through an approach that emphasizes resiliency. If you want to join our conversation, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date today. Matthijs Bouw is director of the Urban Resilience Certificate Program at the University of Pennsylvania. So what are you doing in these major projects around the world these days, where sea levels are rising, threatening cities like New York City, maybe Miami down in Florida? What kind of approach are you taking to that challenge?
Well, I think there's a number of things that are very important to realize. There's a lot of people and activity happening in floodplains all over the world. And to protect all of them will be very, very difficult. So we're going to have to make choices about where do we give the create space for the water and learn to live with it, and what are the areas to protect. And then once you start to think about the areas that you want to protect, you can, for instance, think like we are doing in Manhattan and Boston. Think about, let's say, green structures along the waterfront and create a sort of new elevated park system. But you also then need to start thinking, how do we, in those areas that we protect, rethink the stormwater system and the drainage, etc. So there you need to work together with the communities and the different agencies in rethinking the city so that there is more space for water, and so that's to make sure that water doesn't all have to drain at the same time, or that it starts to create flood events where it mixes with sewage and creates not only pollution but also health risks. And those health risks, specifically in the emerging economies, are very, very real.
You create more space for water in those areas through what kinds of ways, Matthijs?
So, as I said earlier, by reducing the amount of of asphalt and concrete and creating space for water there, often you see in urban areas that on apartment buildings, people are starting to make what they call blue roofs, which store a couple of inches of water. You basically want to sort of disconnect some of the stormwater system from the sewage system, so that when so that there's less chance of overflows, as they call it, during very large rain events. But basically, what you do is you work with the communities and the different layers of government in finding the space for water in the city, in the roadbeds, in gardens, in the way you make your parks, on the roofs. You need to in some way do everything at the same time in order to be able to manage this water.
You know, given the magnitude of the risk that global warming is presenting to us, how willing are industries and municipalities and businesses to doing what you're talking about, to putting green layers on top of buildings to help absorb the water you're talking about?
That really depends. And it very much depends on what is the time horizon of a particular industry or of a particular government. Climate change is something that is sort of creeping up on us. We need to start preparing now for the decades and the century ahead. And often businesses like real estate developers have a sort of much lower time horizon. They want to make sure that they do the project and then sell it off. So their time horizon is not decades or a century, but it's basically 4 years, as mm-hmm. sometimes it is in government. And what is very important is to find the argument of why it is important to think in the long term. And one of the things there, for instance, it says, well, you as a developer can have a 4-year outlook because then you want to sell, but the people who will buy the houses or the apartments will have a 30-year mortgage. Mm-hmm. And if they understand the 30-year scope and they start to price that in to what they are willing to pay for a building that is resilient versus a building that is not resilient, then suddenly you can increase the time horizon and then increase the possibility for people investing in these longer term adaptation.
As you, again, as you watch the world reacting to climate change, do you think people are moving quickly enough to adapt, or do you worry about the pace that all this is occurring?
I'm very double in that. I think the magnitude of the challenges ahead are really serious. We're going to have to do a lot of work to adapt to climate and to mitigate climate, to make sure that we don't put a whole lot more carbon in the air. At the same time, I do see that, for instance, in the United States, with all the big storms that have happened in the last couple of years, there's an incredible new awareness of these changes. And I also love the fact that people are ingenious. They once they commit to something, changes can happen very quickly. So the fact that people are increasingly aware of climate change, that it has started to be part of a political conversation, makes me very hopeful.
Which cities in this country on the coast are you most worried about when it comes to rising seawater?
I think Miami is an obvious candidate, and that has to do with the fact that much of southern Florida is at a really low elevation. So by the end of the century, it's going to flood very, very frequently. But it also has the problem that it's built on a very porous limestone. Mm-hmm. So that means that traditional measures such as levees and barriers don't actually work in that condition. So that makes me very, very worried.
That's Matthijs Baum. He was just in town talking about resilient architecture, its importance in the wake of global warming. Again, he's director of the Urban Resilience Certificate Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Matthijs, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great day.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with an award-winning author about gunplay in Chicago and what that city's doing or not doing to deal with it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Monday on the show, redesigns at the National Bio and Agrodefense Facility out in Manhattan, Kansas, have put the federal project years behind schedule. We delved into the controversy surrounding that building. You can listen to it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, one Kansas family is asking lawmakers for a medical exemption that would allow them to treat symptoms of their daughter's rare medical condition with CBD oil. We'll find out why that's causing a stir tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City is hardly the only city in the country with a violent crime problem. In Chicago, over the past 20 years, more than 14,000 people have been killed and another 60,000 wounded by gunfire. Stopping the madness there has proven to be just as challenging as it has here in Kansas City. Author Alex Kotlowitz doesn't provide a lot of answers in his new book that looks at the stories behind the victims in the summer of 2013 in Chicago, but he leaves readers with the unmistakable impression that all the shootings and the murders and the injuries are having an enormous impact on those left behind. Alex writes this in his latest book, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. He's also the author of the national bestseller, There Are No Children Here, which the New York Public Library picked as one of the 150 most important books of the 20th century. He's also a George Polk Award winner, and he's won two Peabody Awards. It's a pleasure to have him with us. Alex, welcome to Up to Date.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You know, you make a point of saying early on here that you don't have answers for all the mayhem in Chicago. And in fact, you say if anybody tells you they have the answers, they're lying. Well, we're having this conversation on the day that Kansas City voters are narrowing the mayoral field from 11 candidates to 2. And one of the big issues has been what to do to stem the violence. So I'm wondering, you know, do answers even exist?
They do, absolutely. I mean, so you're right. I'm very upfront at the beginning of this book that this is that I'm not dealing with public policy, in part because, you know, what I do is tell stories. And for me, the power of narrative is that not that they answer questions, but that they ask them.
Right.
But it's clear that, you know, there are things that we know. Look, for example, in Chicago, and I suspect this is probably the case in Kansas City, the vast majority of the violence takes part place in communities that are deeply distressed.
Right.
And so there's a clear connection between this lack of or opportunity, loss of hope, and this kind of lashing out, this sense of anger. It's also clear, too, the easy accessibility of guns. I mean, in Chicago, for example, every year the police take off the streets 7,000 to 10,000 guns. Mm. And so it's clear that the accessibility of guns has led to this stubborn persistence of the violence. And, you know, what my book is so much about, as you said, is really about how the violence sort of impacts the spirit of both individuals and community. And I think we've completely underestimated that. And there are programs now that are beginning to grapple with this trauma, with people emerging from this violence, either as victims who've lost loved ones. It doesn't go away. It stays with you. It gets in your bones.
This notion that people in Chicago, like here in Kansas City, are walking around in this permanent state of PTSD, right? That's what you're talking about.
Right. Though I want to be clear. I mean, certainly they have symptoms of what we think of as PTSD, what we certainly saw in veterans returning from combat from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, people who are easy to anger, who have trouble sleeping, who are have trouble concentrating, often self-medicate. But the difference is in these communities, there's nothing post about it. You lose a loved one day, and the next day you're looking over your shoulder to make sure that something doesn't happen again.
I was struck, too. You know, Kansas City is like Chicago in the sense that, you know, officials there have tried community policing. They've tried focusing more officers in high crime areas. They've tried wraparound services and use of social workers. And yet here we are, you know, and you wonder in this town particularly that none of that seems to be particularly effective at lowering the violent crime rates. You can't help but get pretty discouraged by it, Alex.
Well, I think you do. You, and especially if you're living in these communities. But again, I go back to this notion, and it feels so self-evident. I almost feel sheepish even mentioning it. But these are neighborhoods that are deeply distressed, mm-hmm. And it seems to me, I mean, we in Chicago, and I suspect again in Kansas City, we're very much a tale of two cities. We've got this kind of blossoming downtown. I think one of the most beautiful downtowns in the world. And you grow up on the south side of Chicago and you walk out of your house every morning and you look at that gleaming skyline and you know what is not yours. Mm-hmm. These are communities that are still reeling from the 2008 housing crisis. There's one story I tell of a young man who's witnessed a number of murders and loses his best friend. And on his block at any singular moment, there were 3 to 6 abandoned properties on his street.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that Chicago police deal with is the same thing that Kansas City police deal with, and that's the no snitch code of the streets. And that was brought to life in the life and death of a young boy in your book named Romaine.
Right.
Tell us what happened to him.
Yeah, and actually, I want in some ways let me tell you his story because I think it actually in some ways challenges that no snitch culture. Myth.
Right.
So Romaine was a young man working a full-time job at Jewel in the meat department, a local grocery store. One evening, he and his girlfriend are standing outside a car with a friend, and a 15-year-old boy rides by on a bicycle, pulls out a gun and shoots, presumably at this other boy, and ends up hitting Romaine, shooting him in the back. And Romaine does something pretty remarkable. He IDs the shooter.
Yes.
To the police and is agreeable to testify. And as it turns out, the boy pleads guilty and goes away to prison. And over the course of the next year, Romaine is faced with these constant threats, presumably from friends and family of this boy. And then on a Saturday afternoon, a year later, in the middle of a park in a very gentrified neighborhood, somebody comes up behind him and shoots and kills him. And there are all these witnesses to it. And what's most notable to me is nobody will come forward. And it has really nothing to do with this no snitch culture. They won't come forward because they're afraid. I mean, they've, you know, seen what happened to Romaine. And it's one of the things that happens in a place where, you know, we have I don't know what Kansas City is like. In Chicago, we have a really low closure rate. So you've got a 3 in 4 chance of killing somebody in Chicago and getting away with it. And one of the consequences of that is there's not much sense of justice. There's not much sense of protection. And as a result, you know, the police know or pretty much know who shot and killed Romaine, but are unable to proceed with the case as a result.
You've mentioned, Alex, this notion that Chicago has these very depressed areas and there's this connection between those areas and crime. But, you know, every city does, and yet Chicago ranks high on these lists of violent cities. Kansas City does. Is there any more thinking as to why Chicago is so susceptible to so much violence? I mean, do officials even know the answer to that?
But, you know, here's the thing. As bad as Chicago is, and I know we've become kind of the poster child for urban violence, it's not even in the top 10 cities. I mean, in fact, St. Louis has a higher per capita homicide rate than Chicago.
I think Kansas City does, too. Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. And so I think one of the reasons Chicago is because of its size, the absolute numbers are so much greater. And for reasons that I don't have an answer to, we've become the epicenter for these horrible murders of and by children. But I don't think Chicago is anywhere at all unique. In fact, I could have written this book in St. Louis, in Kansas City, in Philadelphia, New Orleans. Chicago just happens to be my home. But for what's clear to me, you know, my first book, you mentioned There Are No Children Here, I wrote almost 30 years ago. And the thing that really knocked me off balance in working on that book was the violence in the lives of the kids that I spend time with. And that violence has not gone away. It's been incredibly stubborn and persistent.
Alex Kotlowitz is my guest. His new book, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, in Chicago, there are these cliques that control not necessarily entire neighborhoods of the city, but just maybe one block of it. And there are hundreds of these groups that control block after block, like mini gangs. What kinds of challenges do they pose to law enforcement? And what's interesting about this to me was the development of these cliques seemed to be a direct reaction, you write in the book, to the police department going after the heads of some of the big gangs in the city. And once after they had done that, the splintering effect occurred and these cliques developed in so many parts of the city.
Right. It's the unintended consequence, I guess,
of
public policy. But you're right. I mean, some 30 years ago, the at least the African-American gangs in the city were highly organized around the drug trade and were very hierarchical and well-organized. In fact, I remember when I was spending time in the projects back then, and if there was a shooting about to take place, we'd usually get warning about it and could have time to take cover.
Wow.
And so as a result, you know, the police in the late 90s went after the head of the snake and arrested all the heads of all these gangs. And as a result, as you say, the gangs splintered. And now the police estimate there are anywhere between 600 to 800 different factions, cliques, crews, whatever you want to call them, that are simply organized street by street. And one of the consequences of that is the violence feels so much more arbitrary, so much more random, and as a result, so much more dangerous.
How do you corral that when you have 600 of these things going on? Yeah.
Right. So, and one of the stories I tell in the book, again, is of this young man, Thomas, who is sitting on a porch and he's with a friend, a young girl, and somebody from another block comes out of the gangway and starts shooting and ends up killing his friend. And it's a story about really this, what I think is this beautiful relationship between Thomas and a social worker he had met in high school, and ultimately about his decision whether or not to testify in that case.
You know, another thing that emerges from these pages is this idea that all these victims you know, that a lot of people think they had it coming to them somehow, that they were inviting trouble through the way they live their lives. But as you point out here, that simply isn't the case. And that's a pretty important concept, isn't it?
Right. I mean, often what you see in the newspaper the next day is that, you know, the victim was involved in a gang or the drug trade. And so what I found often, especially parents, were often really defensive about their child. And there's a story in the book about a gentleman, George Spivey, who gets out of prison after being there for 14 years. And he's absolutely – George is this remarkable man. He's just absolutely committed to reconnecting with his son. I mean, mm-hmm. they've had a relationship, and they're slowly beginning to build that trust back. And then on an afternoon, his son is, in a case of mistaken identity, is shot and killed. And George is interviewed that next morning. He's sitting on the stoop. He's a very thoughtful man. And, you know, one of the things he tells the reporter interviewing him is he talks about what a good young man his son was. He was headed off to college. And the idea that that's what you have to do in the wake of having lost a child speaks volumes about this notion that I think people outside of these neighborhoods often think that people kind of who get shot had it coming to them somehow.
Yeah. You know, even the perpetrators, you know, Alex, what struck me about some of them, they seem to have these divided personalities or existences. They seem like, you know, good, conscientious kids one minute, and the next they're making these incredibly bad choices. You know, what's the takeaway there?
Well, listen, I mean, I think that sort of speaks to all of us, right? We're all complicated people. I think, you know, you live in a community like this and the stakes are raised. And, you know, there is a story of a young boy, Marcelo, who at the age of 16 is shot. And he, you know, he knows the only way he's going to make it is to get out of his neighborhood. And he actually gets himself into this jewel of a place, Mercy Home for Boys and Girls. The thing about him is he's, on the one hand, he's a member of a gang. On the other hand, he's a straight-A student at one of the top parochial schools in the city. You know, as his friends would call him, they called him the stupid smart kid. and so Marcelo goes to Mercy. He's doing wonderful. He goes home one day and he goes out with some friends and they end up robbing some other kids of cell phones. And it was pretty violent. I mean, they didn't have weapons, but the fists and he ends up getting arrested. And it's a story about walking this tightrope. You know, Marcel's this really, he's just terrific kid. In fact, I'm giving away a little bit of his story. I mean, he's about to graduate from college, but the truth of the matter is there's not a whole lot of room in these neighborhoods to make mistakes. And we were all there once as adolescents, and my God, did we make some bad choices. The only problem is here, the stakes are so much higher.
Yeah, this notion that the worlds of good and evil aren't that far apart. You talk to a man who worked with Marcelo, Tom Gilardi, who says he gets so frustrated with the divided nature of so many of his clients who are responsible one minute and doing crazy stuff the next. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our guest again, Alex Kotlowitz, his new book, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Let's go to Linda from Kansas City on the Missouri side. Linda, good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Go ahead, Linda.
Oh, well, I heard the mayor recently told me in a forum on gun violence that there's absolutely nothing to be done except for money. And I've been doing artwork. I'm an artist on this for more than 10 years now. All of the statistics around the world say less guns, less violence. But we need an adult in the room that will help us do that. Our hands are tied in Kansas City because of the state legislature, so we can't do that by ourselves in this city. Mitch McConnell won't let the vote come to Congress in our national thing, even though the House has voted to have at least background checks. Nobody talks about getting rid of gun shows. In fact, someone, a man that is representing Missouri in our state Congress, just put up a bill that everybody 21 years or older should have access to a gun, and they can get a 75% tax write-off.
Linda, I'm going to have to move on here. What Linda's referring to is a state lawmaker, Alex, in Jefferson City, who was saying everybody should have a gun. How much difference would it make if we could impose gun control in our major cities? Because you talk to some police officers in Kansas City, Alex, and they'll say there's so many guns out there, it wouldn't make any difference because everyone could still be able to get a gun for years to come.
Right. Well, it's true. I mean, I think the estimates are there's 300 million guns in circulation. So if you tomorrow stop producing guns, there's more than enough to go around. But here's this is really a national issue. Chicago actually has reasonably strict gun control laws. And the problem is that the neighboring states, mainly Indiana, it's really easy to get weapons and to get semi-automatics with extended magazines. And I do think we're at a place in this country where we need to begin to have a reasonable and rational conversation about gun control. Look, I love to fish. I think absolutely people should be able to hunt and own guns, but we have to have a conversation about the availability, especially the availability of high-tech weaponry, semi-automatics, with magazines and some extended magazines, and also have some simply control over who can own a weapon. That's a conversation we have to have nationally. It's not gonna work if we do it city by city.
But it seems that conversation is so elusive, doesn't it?
It is, but I think we're at a place in the wake of, Newton and Newtown and Parkland that
right.
I think that conversation is going to take place.
Imani from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. There have been studies that predict that violence can be predicted according to third grade literacy rates. And school funding is based on property taxes, which breeds inequality. You're always going to have lower income property taxes, which is always going to produce poor schools. And it really seems as though that we have symptomatic remedies and not systemic solutions.
What about that, Alex?
Well, I do think there is a real inequity of funding when it comes to education. Education schools is seen as a kind of transcendent institution in our nation, the one place where you can go and pull yourself up from your social or economic status. And of course, it's pretty much an American myth at the moment. And you look at Chicago and look at the inequity that exists in the schools. So there's no question, the caller before talked about money, and I don't want to suggest at all that money is by any means the only issue here, but the lack of resources in these communities is something that needs such immediate attention. But again, I feel like this is something we know and we've known for so long that the question I ask is, where's everybody been?
I was also struck about another person that you profile in this book, Peter Nicias.
Right.
And maybe I was drawn to him only because I began my career here in Kansas City as a cop reporter. And here's Peter, a 27-year-old police reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He starts off all gung-ho about the beat he's covering and excited about what's going on, tweets all the time, very communicative. But all the tragedies he witnesses and he writes about winds up taking a pretty heavy toll on him. What happened to him?
Yeah, so Pete's he's this kind of remarkable guy. He comes in at the Tribune as a young reporter, a cub reporter, and he carves out this beat for himself where he's working nights. He gets in, begins work at 10 p.m. at night and stops at 6 a.m. Yeah. And he goes out and he spends all his time out on the streets. He's got a portable police scanner. He's going from crime scene to crime scene. And initially, there's a sense of exhilaration and excitement, and he's tweeting, and he's actually become the police on the streets become a big fan of his. And I think, as you say, over time, it begins to take its toll on him. He's beginning to feel sometimes that he's at places where he doesn't want to be, where he's witness to things that feel so private. There's a man who wants to pray over the body of his son. He gets to one scene early, and he's there before the medics.
Yes.
And has to try to keep somebody from bleeding out. And he promises himself that he'll never be the first one on the scene again. And so Pete starts to drink. He finds himself agitated all the time. And then he gets this tattoo, which for me has really stayed with me. It's from a line from Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses, yes. And it reads, "The closest bonds we will ever know are bonds of grief, the deepest community one of sorrow." And I think what Pete is saying is he's begun to connect with the people in these communities who are grieving. Pete now is actually finishing up a year at Harvard as a Nieman Fellow.
I was going to ask you what he's doing.
He's a remarkable journalist.
Yeah. I'm wondering the impact of covering all this violence and exposing yourself to all this violence. What impact did it have on you?
Yeah, you know, I get asked this more than I thought I would, and I feel a little hesitant to say, because I feel that I know what everybody else has gone through, all the people I spend time with. Having said that, I will tell you that there was a moment when I was beginning to write and I fell into this really deep depression. I mean, unlike anything I've experienced before, I had no sense of joy. I couldn't smile. I just wanted to be by myself. And I didn't know what was going on. And I think now, looking back on it, it was this kind of what you know psychologists call secondary or visceral trauma. And you see that, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned the social worker earlier, and she experienced that as well. In fact, she loses the feeling on one side of her face, and there's no question that was a kind of secondary trauma she was experiencing.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, before you go here, what is changing out there when it comes to the police, the criminal justice system? Because you've pointed out that you do see some positive changes beginning to sort of creep into the system. Tell us about that.
I think the big change over recent years is this: people beginning to sort of view violence as a matter of public health, that it's not just a police matter. And so you've got people now beginning to deal, for example, with the trauma of individuals and communities. And that just feels so essential.
One of the groups you've worked with, the Interrupters, you were a co-producer of a documentary there. They work the streets. They're aware of the tensions. They try to diffuse things before things get ugly. We have a similar group here, Aim for Peace. How effective do you think these groups are at what they do?
Yeah, I think on a individual basis, they make a huge difference. You know, they go out. They're usually young men. Well, not young. I mean, men and women in their 40s, 50s, who used to run the streets, kind of testament to the fact that people have second acts in life, and they're kind of out there to undo some of the wreckage, the damage that they were so much a part of. And as you say, they go out there, they've got credibility, they go and they interrupt disputes before they turn into something more violent. And it's clear to me that sometimes all that people need is somebody to listen to them, to hear them, to hear their grievances.
That's Alex Kotlowitz, his new book, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Alex, you produced another good one. I'm a big fan of your work, and I sure appreciate what you do.
Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
All the best to you. You bet.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on the show, the Kansas City mayor's race will become a whole lot clearer after today's primary voting. We'll break down what happened in the elections on tomorrow's program. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, is attention deficit disorder, is it overdiagnosed? Family psychologist Wes Crenshaw talked about it. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up to date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.